Welcome to JW Community Podcast, where my mum is basically just blabbering on about nonsense.
Thank you, Phil. Hello, and welcome to JW Community Podcast. If you thought the last podcast was good, where we interviewed the best activist that you've never heard of, here's the next best activist that you've never heard of. But first of all, I'm going to introduce Lara. Hi, Lara. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Louise. And I'm happily back home, recovering from a cold I caught near your house.
Yeah.
And the thing is about our guest is his initials are JW. So
really?
I guess I'll now introduce him. It's Jason Wynn from Ireland. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Louise.
Hi.
And the thing about Jason is he's kind of similar to Stephen. He's in the Northern Hemisphere while Stephen lives in the Southern Hemisphere. So it was really lovely to introduce them to each other when we were recently in the UK for the protest. I've got a question for Jason.
Go on.
Jason, recently we listened to your awesome podcast that was recorded with XJW Fifth. And I hope people listen to that podcast because it tells them your background, your family history, how you became an activist, and really a lot about Avoid JW, which is why we want to talk to you again today. So my question is, recently when we visited you, you got photographed not drinking Guinness. Can you tell us more about your drinking habits? Start with that.
Yeah, well, let me explain first of all that I used to be a Guinness drinker. And I actually like Guinness, but I think that particular night that we were in that pub, there's two reasons why there's no Guinness. One is because I don't drink Guinness, and two, Stephen wanted to try some other drink. So instead of Guinness, I got him to drink Smithwick's, and Smithwick's is an Irish drink as well, and it's quite nice. I don't drink at all now. I'm a teetotaler, so I didn't have any alcohol. Now, I had a beer, but it's a non-alcoholic beer. So that's the reason why there was no Guinness on the tables.
And he took a photo of that one, introduced him to Smitty's.
Yes.
And I think he's going to try and source it here in Australia.
Yeah, it's a nice beer.
Yeah, he enjoyed it. So my second question, totally unrelated to activism, but we're really interested in getting to know you as a person, is can you tell us the story about how you met and fell in love with your wife?
Okay, well, she was an apostate just like me. No, just she's not a Jehovah's Witness at all, never was a Jehovah's Witness. She actually comes from a family of non-religious people, which is really great, really, because we never have arguments over religion.
That's good.
But how did I meet this lady? Well, I used to be a huge U2 fan, and I used to go into U2 chat rooms. And one particular time, I went into a chat room, and I pretended to be three or four different people at the same time. And I had an argument with myself. So just imagine three or four different people all acting differently, trying to be the right person in a particular argument. Now, I can't remember what the argument was. But there's a feature in it where you could go and have a private conversation with someone in the chat room. So she private messaged me and she says, you're all those people, aren't you? I said, no, they're all different people. She says, no, there's something about the argument. She says, it's one person and I'm sure you're all of them. And I was kind of taken aback that she actually figured it out, because even people that would have been in the room, a lot of them would have become friendly with me over months. This girl was the first time I'd seen her in the chat room, and she knew straight away it was one and the same person.
Wow.
So anyway, we continued conversing over a number of months, and she was a nanny at the time. She's originally from Germany, but she was a nanny at the time in New York. And then she went back to Germany, went back to college, and every now and again she'd send me a postcard. But then she got a scholarship to go out to Santa Cruz and went to the university out there, and she spent a year out there. And I'd get a postcard every now and again from her, and sometimes an email. But there was never real kind of big conversations between us. It was just kind of letting each other know what we were doing with our lives, you know, and I'd send her emails and what have you. But anyway, she got back to Germany in 2006, and she says, oh, from going from California to Germany is just so miserable. People are just so miserable. Why can't they be all lovely and happy like they are over in California? And I says, well, why don't you come over to Ireland? She says, oh, sure, I have no money. I says, look, I'll pay for you to come over. All you have to do is just get over here. You have a place to stay and all the rest, and you can enjoy yourself in Ireland. So she says, okay. And so I had to go up to Dublin to pick her up. Now, I only had one picture she had ever sent of me, so I wasn't really sure if I'd recognize her, because the picture was maybe 3 or 4 years old. But I got up to the airport, and I went into the shop, and I was thinking, I better get her flowers or something. So I went and got 12 roses, and I had this big, huge bunch of roses in my hand, and I'm there waiting at the arrivals hall, and I'm looking at the 12 roses, and I'm going, this is too much, Jess, too much, too many flowers. She thinks I'm going to be full on or something. So I took out one rose, and I had 11 more. And I went up to some lady that was with her husband, and I says, would you like 11 roses? She just looks at me, I don't want your flowers.
What the heck? Wait, stop.
I wasn't expecting that kind of reaction, but I just went, all right, all kind of flustered. I just threw them all into the bin except this one rose.
So you bought 12 roses. You bought 12 roses for a woman you'd never met, and you gave 11 of them to a woman you'd never met.
Exactly.
Oh, you're lovely.
So anyway, I have this one rose left, and you know, it was full of thorns. I'm like, oh, it's too thorny. So I started taking off the thorns. I was taking off the leaves.
God.
So by the time Marilyn came out from the thing, I had this rose that was completely and utterly naked. It was just a stem with the flower at the top. And I seen her coming out, and I knew it was her straight away, so I gave her a wink, and she just, her whole face just lit up. And anyway, she came out, and I had this big huge, I just gave her the flower. She was delighted with the flower.
Your wife-to-be.
This is my wife-to-be. And she said, like, I brought it out, and I had this big, huge Jeep. Now, anyone that knows anything about Japanese cars, I'll give you the name of it. It's a Mitsubishi Delica. It's a four-wheel drive, eight-seater van, and the back seats can actually turn into a bed if you want to. Cool. It was a coolio. And she comes out, and she's just like, this is different. So, anyway, a number of years later, we ended up becoming a couple, and then we got married. But she said to me, sometime after that, she said, you got me at the wink. So I don't know what kind of wink I have, but it must be magic. Because we're still together, and that's 12 years ago now.
That's amazing. So
that's a lovely story.
Thank you.
That's an amazing story. So at this juncture, I'd quite like to say hello to somebody that I met at the protest, somebody quite special. And I just quite like the story where you bought 12 red roses for somebody that you'd never met before, and now you're married to her.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. Moving on. So, Jason, tell us about your activism.
Well, I'm an accidental activist, want to put it that way. I come from a divided household. Now, as Lara has mentioned, if anyone wants to know all about the background to my life, they should look at XJW the Fifth and look at the interview he did with me. It was a pleasure doing an interview with XJW the Fifth. But that gives you a great background into my life as a person. But I got into activism because I come from a divided household, and my mum was talking to me on and off all the time, even though I've been disfellowshipped since 2001. But in 2012, she came out to the house and she said she's not going to talk to me anymore. And I said, okay, ma'am, that's your choice if that's what you want to do. So off she went, and she hasn't spoken to me since, except at my dad's funeral. But that's been the only time that she spoke to me since. But in 2014, two elders called out to my house for a conversation, and it was them that contacted me. They said, gave me a phone call and said, would I mind them calling to see me? And I says, no problem at all. Yeah, you're more than welcome. So they came out for 75 minutes and had a conversation. And in that conversation, I made it very clear to them that, look, I know what I'm disfellowshipped for, and that's not the issue. I said, the issue I have is why I'm disfellowshipped. And I've never been able to find out the answer to that. And that's been bugging me, because I was always of the opinion that you're disfellowshipped because you're unrepentant. Yet I was repentant at that time, but I was still disfellowshipped. So there's something more to it than you're telling me. So they said, yeah, we'll go and find that out for you. And that was in March 2014. In July 2014, I met one of those elders again, and I asked him again, have you been able to find out? And he says, oh, I haven't found out yet. I'll get that for you. Then I heard nothing until October 2014. In October 2014, I called out to their Kingdom Hall. That's just around the corner, actually, from my house. I walked up there, and I asked him to come outside. So he came out into the lobby area, because they have the Kingdom Hall in a hotel. Mm. They rent a room. And for an hour with him and another fella, I had a big, huge conversation and asked about this, why and why are you not giving me any of the information? I don't know why they still haven't. I mean, I still haven't found out why. But in the meantime, they said they'd go off and find out, but they never did, right? Back even in October. So three times they told me they'd go and find out and come back to me, and they never did. But my brother, who isn't a Jehovah's Witness, he says, have you ever researched them? I says, no, I'd never go researching them. It's all apostate lies. He says, well, if it's lies, you know it's lies. Why don't you just go check? So that sent me down the rabbit hole, as it were. And I discovered the lies. And, you know, when you start to discover the lies about how Watchtower have said things and twisted things, you suddenly get angry and annoyed that you've been duped all this time. And, you know, you talk to many ex-JWs who have gone down that hole. A lot of them have gone through those stages of anger first, you know, yeah. Frustration. And I suppose in one sense, you could get extremely angry and all pissed off and stay that way, or you can channel it some way. So I figured, well, I'm going to channel it. I'm going to figure out, you know, I said, I'm what really, really irritated me the most is that there's been secret documents and secret policies used against me and thousands of other people in judicial committees, because most people in those judicial committees are never aware that there's secret manuals and secret policies that they use against you. And that's the why. That's why I was disfellowshipped.
Right.
They weren't following Bible principles. What they're following was a manual. The manual tells them that they have to go this way, and if they don't answer it this way, then definitely then they're not repentant, and so then you just kick them out.
Wait, so why were you disfellowshipped?
Why was it disfellowshipped?
Yeah.
Because right, there's three stages. It's the first one is if you haven't prayed to God. So if you bring reproach on Jehovah, that's number one.
You haven't prayed to God.
If you don't pray to God, you know, like to apologize.
Okay.
You know, so if you bring reproach on Jehovah, bring reproach on the Watchtower, because Jehovah Watchtower is one and the same. That's number one. If you break that rule, then no matter how repentant you are, it's no different.
So you didn't pray to God?
I didn't pray to God.
Okay.
And then rule number two is if too many people know about it.
Sorry, yeah. Too many people know that you haven't prayed to God. This is
have found out your sin. Okay. Your serious sin. Too many people know about your serious sin. So okay. That's number two. If you break that one, then no matter how repentant you are, it makes no difference.
Okay.
And then rule number three then is being repentant, showing repentance.
Yeah, and they said you didn't, and you said you did. But yeah, but what was the thing that you did? Like most people do a thing, like they do the noughties with a lady, or
that was it. It was sex outside of marriage.
Okay.
But you know, if it's sex outside of marriage, right, you should be allowed to be sorry for it.
Yeah, of course you should be allowed to be sorry for it.
You should be repentant. But the problem was, right, it didn't bring reproach on Jehovah, but too many people knew about it.
Right, yeah.
That's why.
Okay.
So therefore, it's going to be this fellowship no matter what. So if you don't know the rules and you go into one of these judicial committees and you don't know the first and second rule, right, if you didn't break any of them, then it falls onto the last rule, which is repentance.
Yeah.
But we're always given the impression that it's all got to do with repentance and nothing to do with repentance. Well, it does.
Yeah.
It's heard in the three rules. So, now I know why I was disfellowshipped. rule one didn't apply, but rule two did, and so therefore repentance is has nothing to do with it. So where was I going with the activism? Oh, yeah. So the whole thing was I was annoyed that secret rules and policies were used against me and thousands of others. So I said, well, let's put them on the internet then.
Yeah.
If I can find them here and I'm finding them there and find them everywhere. What really annoyed me about all these policy documents is that they were all hidden and secretly released on JW Network and Reddit and Facebook and other places. I'm like, why are they all just being willy-nilly thrown all over the internet for people to try and figure out what's here and there? I mean, there's loads of child abuse cases going on, and solicitors need these, lawyers need these documents, and how do they get them easily unless they know? And they don't know. We only know because we know we're in a network of ex-JWs.
Yeah.
Yep. So I said, I'm going to create a website where they can be all put up and all catalogued. So hence, I created the Void JW, and the whole point of it was so that policies, secret policies, documents could be in one place, easily found, downloaded, and used. And that's how I started in activism.
You just wanted people to see all the secret stuff that was being used against them, right?
I wanted people, I felt like if you look at, right, if you were a Bible person and you believe in it,
yeah,
it says, I think it's Mark 4:22, that the secrets will be revealed and that sort of stuff.
So you were revealing the secrets.
Revealing the secrets. I mean, nothing will be concealed. It'll all have to be come out. So I says, yeah. Mark 4:22, out on the open, everyone should know. Why should there be secrets against their own members?
Yes,
like, could you imagine if it was Moses down back in, when they're wandering around in the desert, and he didn't bother showing them the Ten Commandments.
Even they were secret.
And then they're breaking them, and then he's just having his own cronies, the guys up on the top going, you gotta kill him. Stone that him with fire. Why was he burned with fire? Oh, you don't need to know.
Secrets. You don't need to know secrets. It's in the sacraments.
God told us, and that's all you need to know. And we're doing the right thing. You see how ridiculous it gets?
Yeah.
You know, it'd be the same thing with, you know, the Jehovah's Witnesses talk about the whole, the New Testament, you know, and the apostles and all that. And everything that they followed was all in the scriptures. So Watchtower uses, you know, the Acts of the Apostles and the Gospels and even the letters to Paul, from Paul and Peter and all those people. And they used that as if that was all the policies they have. Now, if they had secret policies back then.
Yeah.
Well, did Watchtower, you know, being God's organization, highly secretive organization, now have those secrets? And then the apostles have secret documents.
Yeah.
And if they didn't record them in the Bible, what happened to them? And why is there a need for Watchtower to have secret documents at all and keep them secret from the rest of the members? Like, definitely all the women can't see them. That 65% whose witnesses straight away have no access to secret documents.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have all the children who make up whatever other percentage. I mean, you're only talking about maybe 20% potentially have access to secret documents, and even that they wouldn't, because a lot of men aren't even elders or ministerial servants, or they're just publishers.
Yeah. So Jason, I'm fascinated by your motivation for this, because I've got close relatives that have said to me, why can't you let it drop? Right? I've not been abused. I've had no horrific history as a witness. Nothing terrible's happened to me. But for some reason, I don't know why, I'm an activist and I can't let it drop. And I don't know why. And I'm kind of seeing you in the same light. There's no horrific history with them, but for some reason you've got your teeth into this issue of secret documents, and it really bugs you, and you want everyone to see these secret documents.
Right, I'll ask you a question. I'll answer the question with a question. When you were at school, were you bullied?
Well, I mean, I was a dweeb. I was like a wiener. I was like the wiener kid, and I struggled to hold my own, and I wouldn't associate myself with any wieners that were worse than me, because I thought, I've got my own wiener issues to deal with. And I just struggled to keep my head above water. So possibly, yeah.
Yeah, you know, a lot of Jehovah's Witnesses were bullied at school.
Yeah.
And I think basically by the nature of the whole religion, they're going to be needlessly bullied just because of the religious persuasion. But yeah, I was bullied at school. So in Ireland, we have 5 years of high school.
Yeah.
And three of those, after three, you have exams. And then after another two, you have more exams. But the first 3 years were probably the hardest.
Yeah.
I got really bullied. But then in that third year, there was one particular guy. And I remember he was always at me. And I used to go home and I'd be in tears. And I says, I just want to stop going to school. I don't want to go to school anymore. So then someone said to me, have you ever confronted him? I says, no. I says, because he'd probably punch me.
Maybe
he won't. So I said, all right, I'll try it. So one day he just was at me and I turned on him and I just says, what is your problem? Do you have a problem with me? Did I ever do that? Well, he stood back. Now, he was a tall lad in our class, you know, quite a big fella. He came from a farming background, so he was quite muscular. He's lifting sheep and goats and what have you. He just turned, stood back and he go, oh, Jay, I was only teasing. I didn't mean to hurt you or hurt your feelings. You know, he was doing that for 3 years, oblivious to the fact that he was bullying me.
Yeah.
We became good friends after that, you know.
Wow.
He was actually a really nice fella, deep down. He just didn't know his teasing had gone a bit too far. You know, and he'd never call me Jason, he'd just call me Jehovah Man. You know.
Yeah.
But what I found was, then there was in the school I went to, there was an awful lot of Jehovah's Witnesses went to us, because, you know, it was a technical college, so you kind of learned the trades. Which is just typical of Jehovah's Witnesses, you know, what they want out of school. So, you know, you learn woodwork and metalwork. But a lot of my friends would have left after the 3 years and not have got the full high school education, which is disastrous, really. You need at least a minimum the 5 years education, but many of them just left after the three, went off, got a trade, and that was it. But, yeah, I remember a lot of them being bullied, but I used to stand up for them and I'd kick the heads off some of the kids if they were at them. Now, you're wondering, what has that got to do with my activism and why I'm doing it? Well, it's because the Watchtower Corporation is a bully.
Yeah.
It's one big, huge bully.
Yeah.
It does is it uses the secrets to bully its members.
Yeah.
So it uses the shunning to bully its members. And it can make sure that everyone conforms to a certain way, and if they don't do it, they're kicked out. And if they're kicked out, they lose their family.
Yeah.
And they know it.
Yeah.
And then what they do, they know that many of them will come back because they'll miss their families. They even admit it in the Watchtower. But, you know, I'm not coming back. I haven't come back. And I don't think I'll ever come back unless things change, that we get rid of the shunning. There's no need for it. You know, and that they change the rules regarding child abuse, and they change the rules regarding the blood transfusion. I mean, that's blood transfusion, particularly, is probably one of the biggest bullying tactics it uses. Because what they're doing is they're saying that they won't disfellowship you, but if you go and get a blood transfusion to save your own life, it's putting the blame on you. You're the one that's disassociated yourself by your actions. You know, and it's just twisting things to bully people. And then even that person who saved their own life by having a blood transfusion, they now feel so low and so shitty about themselves that, you know, and now they're being shunned by their family and friends just because they wanted to live.
Jason, we talked about that last year. And what I liked was how you couch things, how you put your spin on things. And I mentioned last year the big issues with child sex abuse, which were all coming out after the Royal Commission. And you actually said that to me then. You said, actually, that's not the biggest issue. The biggest issue is shunning. And I totally changed that day you said that to me, and I realised you were right. And we've certainly been talking about it online over the past year or so, how much the shunning damages people, controls them. But it is the underlying issue in the Jehovah's Witnesses. It's not just child sex abuse, because, you know, only a certain proportion of people suffer from that, but everybody suffers from shunning. And I think I've said that before. Whether you are being shunned or you have to shun, you suffer from shunning as a Jehovah's Witness.
Yes.
So I think that was a really, really good point that you made, and I love the spin that you put on your story so that you can see things from a different perspective. Let me ask you another question. You used to be under the radar, and we didn't know your name, your face, and then you came out because you were supporting people regarding child abuse, child custody, and just general support in Ireland, and you were featured in a newspaper article. Can you tell us something about that?
Well, so what happened really is that, well, I suppose there's an awful lot of things that have happened. Where do I begin? Let's go back to around April to about July 2017. A number of documents came into my possession, and there was an individual in Ireland that got in contact with another bunch of activists, and they got in contact with me because I was based in Ireland. What happened was there was a case of child abuse in Ireland, and one of the elders in that congregation wanted to report it to the police, and they didn't want the branch wouldn't allow them to report it. That's for the parents to do it if they want. But the thing is that one of the parents was the abuser. Well, he's a stepfather. So he went off on holidays, and then he comes back from holidays, and he says that when he comes back from holidays and never reported, then he's going to report. So off he went and he reported this. So the Gardaí then started their investigations, and in the meantime, the branch sent over four lads, two from the UK and two from Ireland, to go to this congregation and discipline the elders, go investigate what happened, and then discipline as necessary. So two elders were deleted. The elder that reported the child abuse and the elder who was the coordinator of the body of elders, he was deleted. Now, he was deleted not because he reported the police. He was deleted because he couldn't keep a control of the situation. So I'd say the COBE will be eventually reinstated as an elder if he hasn't already, and the other fellow will probably never be an elder ever again because he was disloyal, you know, not loyal to the corporation, or aka Jehovah, whatever you want to call it. And so that's when I wrote a letter then. I wrote a 6-page letter and I sent it to every Kingdom Hall in Ireland, to all the bodies of elders.
Wow.
And I discussed that article in it, and I discussed the whole child abuse. And I also brought out the point that, right, there was a case of child abuse within my family, but it had nothing to do with Jehovah's Witnesses. But the Jehovah's Witness elders helped in that case, and they helped report the child abuse to the police. And I was saying, how come they could help my family report it to the police when it's not involving Jehovah's Witnesses, but they can't do it when it does involve Jehovah's Witnesses?
Absolutely.
So that's just, you know, the hypocrisy is huge. So that letter was sent. A lot of the letters got opened and read, but some didn't, because by the time the letters came in, a lot of phone calls were being made to the branch. The branch then had to quickly call every coordinator or body of elders that as soon as they got that letter to destroy it because it came from an apostate. But the damage was already done. It didn't matter if they called me apostate or that others didn't read it. It was enough. And I sent out that letter on the July 3rd. I wanted to make sure that it got there before the Circuit Assembly in 2017, which was being held from the 14th to the 16th of July. So I got there in time, and I'm saying that everybody of elders should be informing any family with children that there's a potential for a paedophile or paedophiles to be in the room beside other children. You know, you go to any Circuit Assembly or District Assembly, children are running around all over the place, in the cubby holes, whatever you want. Paedophile just has to be hidden away, and it can easily, you know, molest a child. Who's to know? And then you're not telling people that there's potentially paedophiles in the audience sitting down next to your own child. So I then, before I wrote that letter, this is where it got very interesting, because before I wrote that letter, on the 9th of June 2017, I was told to go to a Kingdom Hall on a Friday night and sit outside and wait. He said, because I was told that inside there's someone of interest for you. Now, I had no idea who was inside. It was just the person told me that when you see that person, it'll dawn on you. So I was like, okay. So I went up to the Kingdom Hall, and there was ministerial servants and elders going into the Kingdom Hall, and I parked my car and I watched them as they went in, and I sat in the car for the 2 hours from 7 o'clock to 9 o'clock. Now, it was the circuit overseer having his meeting with all the bodies of elders and ministerial servants. After an hour, the ministerial servants came out and they all gave me a glare as they walked past my car up into their own cars. I just smiled at them. Then the elders came out an hour later. I got out of my car. And I went up to the gate and went in the gate. And as they came out, I was just waiting to see the one person that would look a little bit odd to me. So, you know, I would have known all these elders and ministerial servants, or most of them anyway. Mm. And then a person came out. I didn't recognize him. I just said, "Are you the circuit overseer?" And he turned his back to me, but he kind of looked at one of the coordinators. Now, there was two coordinators of body of elders, but he looked at one of them, and that one kind of nodded as in to say, "Yeah, that's him." And I said, I shouted again, "Hello, are you the circuit overseer?" And he goes, "Yes, I am." I said, "My name's Jason Wynne. What's your name?" He says, "Mark." I says, "Mark, as in surname." He then turned to his father, which turned out to be his father, and started speaking in Irish. Then it dawned on me who he was. His name is Mark O'Malley. He was in the Bethel in World Headquarters for years, and then moved back to Ireland in 2008. But I wasn't sure if he was the same Mark O'Malley that I knew, because there was a Mark O'Malley as a director of the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society of Ireland, and he was made a director in 2008 when he was sent back. So he was sent back to Ireland to become a director. And it was the same guy. And this guy, which was also interesting about this person, is he is also the very first person I ever went out on field service with. He was about 17 and 18. I was 9 years of age. And we went and did a whole day of preaching. Now, he didn't molest me or anything. He's not a paedophile. Just so you know.
Thank you.
He's actually a really nice man. He comes from a really nice family. But he then turns to me and he says, "Jason, I understand you're disfellowshipped." I said, "Yes, I am." He says, "I am not permitted to talk to you." Now, I found that extremely interesting, because what he is saying, as director of Watchtower Bible and Tract Society of Ireland, which is an entity that represents Jehovah's Witnesses in Ireland, he's saying that he is not permitted to talk to another Jehovah's Witness. Now, you're probably wondering, but you're not a Jehovah's Witness. But I am a Jehovah's Witness. And we'll get into that later. So I then just turned around. I didn't say any more. I just turned around. I got into the car and I drove off. Now, I know that all those elders that were sitting there thinking, "Wow, he wasted 2 hours of his life just to have that short conversation." Mm. But that was an extremely important conversation in my activism, that eventually the Jehovah's Witnesses discovered how important it was just a couple of weeks ago. And we'll come into that later on. So that was on June 9th. You know, he wouldn't talk to me. So then June 11th, which was a Sunday, I turned up at the meeting and I came in and I sat down. And he was actually talking about Malawi, and he was giving praise about the women who got tortured and raped. And he even mentioned the fact that even brothers at the Bethel kind of went and signed the card, but the women didn't. And I shook my head looking at him and I'm going, the women did it because they don't know the secrets. You know, they think that God is with them. The guys at the branch know that it's all just politics, you know, that's being run by the world headquarters. The legal department tells them what to do. And then you then go, I'm going to sign this. I'm not going to go and become a martyr for your silliness. You know, but they wouldn't tell the women. You know, so all the women get tortured, but the lads didn't. And yes. In my head, you're just such bastards. Absolute fucking bastards. And here you are trying to sell them as martyrs. Oh, I was ripping. But he was looking down at me throughout the whole meeting, you know, because he was doing the circuit. And he was acting as a circuit overseer. And he was looking down. And he was extremely nervous of me being there because he knew that I was going to have a conversation with him afterwards. So I knew that if I stay there and if I try and have a conversation with him afterwards, all these elders are going to come down on me like a ton of bricks, and I'm not going to have that conversation. Because as soon as I came into the Kingdom Hall, all the elders got up, some went off into the back room. You can be sure they called the branch to find out what to do with me. And then they came back in and they repositioned themselves, two sat right behind me, then to the side of me. I mean, when I go into a Kingdom Hall, there is fear in those elders' faces. Yes. When they see me. They don't know what I'm going to do. So this I knew, and then I'm sitting there, and then he was looking at me extremely nervously the whole time. Every time he looked down, there was a nervous look in his face. So I realized I can't have a conversation with him. So I got up and I just left just before he had finished up, because there's no point having the conversation. I'm not going to cause a disruption. So off I went, and then on June 16th, which was the following week, there was another circuit overseer at another Kingdom Hall, and I went there just before 7 o'clock, before it started. And this was the letter. So this was the same letter that I issued to all the bodies of elders, but it's a couple of weeks beforehand. And I went up to the door, and the coordinator of the body of elders, who I'd known, he was there, and he was looking at me with, like, complete fear. You should see the look. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. I'm not a very tall man. I'm 5'9". Mm-hmm. You know? So I'm not a very tall man. And the man, the COB in this congregation, he is about 6'2", 6'3", and he's well built. Big man. He was standing there in the hallway, and I come into in the doorway, and he looks at me kind of thing, and I said, "Hi, Clive." He looks, "Hi, Jason," as in, "What are you doing here?" You know? And I says, "Here, have this letter," and I handed it to him, and I says, "That's about a child abuse case in this country." I says, I turned around and I start walking out the door, and I says, "You tell Mark O'Malley I want to talk with him." So, no, nothing back from Mark O'Malley. Mark didn't get in contact with me. I then met, two days before that, I actually met another elder. They were doing the cart witnessing, and I gave him the same letter. And I said, "Tell Mark O'Malley I want to talk with him, and if he doesn't talk with me, I'll go public." So, that was between the 9th of June right the way through to the 16th of June. On the 23rd of June, which is a week after the 16th of June, right, so the next Friday after that, the Watchtower contacted the Sunday Business Post to do a PR piece on their upcoming convention. So they knew that I was going to go public. So to counteract anything I might do, they went and contacted the Sunday Business Post. And they wanted just to get in that they're great people and all the rest. So Barry Weiss, who was on the Business Post, turned up on the 14th of July at the convention. But on the 14th of July, he also contacted a number of XJWs through an XJW, Daniel. Is it Daniel? I can't think of his first name. It's O'Donnell, anyways. No, maybe it's not Daniel O'Donnell because he's a singer, but O'Donnell. Some O'Donnell fella, anyways.
Some O'Donnell fella. And that's beautiful.
So anyway, the Sunday Business Post is a great paper because they always want to get two sides of the argument. They don't want to just have a one-sided article, and that's always great, you know, to be able to get two sides and let the reader then decide for themselves. So they wrote this was a PR piece for the Jehovah's Witnesses, but they also wanted to get from those who were former members so that they could have a balanced article. So they got some stories from a number of former Jehovah's Witnesses. Now, when he spoke with me, he says, "Look, I'm going to talk to you again," he says, "because this, what you're talking about isn't appropriate for this newspaper, or for this article that he's doing, right? So that's when he brought out the Meet the Jehovah's Witnesses, which was brought out on the 16th of July, 2017. So then after that, he got in contact and I sent him the letter that I had sent to all the elders. And he says, yeah, this is definitely newsworthy, but he says it would be interesting to try and find out, is there any other child abuse cases? So all the way through from July all the way to October, Barry went and did intensive research to find out as much as he could about this case and any other cases that there were. And that's when he brought out the article on October 29th, 2017 about failure to bear witness was the title of it. And it was a really damning article, especially when he had the rapporteur on child abuse also making a comment about Jehovah's Witnesses having a dreadful policies related to child abuse, you know?
Yeah.
So where was I going here with this?
So you were telling us about the newspaper. Oh, sorry, you go ahead.
Yes. This was Barry got to know me, right? So then what happened was after that, I tried to go to a circle assembly and I wasn't let in. In fact, what they did was they put up signs all over the place saying private event just so they could stop me going in. And it didn't matter. It didn't matter whether I was on my own or if there was 100 people with me. They were not going to let Jason Wynn in that door. You know, I know too much about the child abuse, I suppose, and their policies and how they operate. And in a small community of Jehovah's Witnesses, you got to understand there's only about 6,500 Jehovah's Witnesses in Ireland. So it's a very small community, very tight-knit. So, you know, even one person knowing anything about the child abuse policies is disastrous for a community that small. So what happened? Something happened then. Because they wouldn't let me in, I took a discrimination case against them. In the meantime, then once that discrimination case was highlighted to the Watchtower, then the Watchtower headquarters, world headquarters, sent me an extremely threatening letter that they were going to sue me for as much money as they possibly could because of the website, for three websites, about JW Serve, HTTP, and some other one. And the thing was, is that by the time they got to Avoid JW, who they thought owned the website, Avoid JW, it was way too late. Because I handed over the ownership of Avoid JW back in June or July of 2017, so it wasn't mine anymore. It'd gone to other people. But so they issued that, and then that started a whole series of articles with the Sunday Business Post, because now what you had is this blogger knows an awful lot about the child abuse, and here they are threatening to sue him and using copyright infringement as the allegation, whereas really the thing that's really bothering them is the fact that there's a huge amount of secret policy documents up there for anyone to access.
Yeah.
So the funny thing in the extremely threatening letter was they wanted me to sign my life away. They wanted I should try. I'll have to get it at some stage and read it out to you, because it's an extremely interesting letter, because there's a lot of people worried about their own. There's been subpoenas issued to a number of activists, and they're all kind of worried, oh, what's Watchtower going to do here? Well, I'll tell you what Watchtower is going to do there. Watchtower is issuing those subpoenas because they need to find out, one, where's the source of the leaks, right? And they haven't found any, you know, they haven't found the source of the leaks. But also what they want to do is see, is there any connection as well with these people to Avoid JW, or even to Jason Wynn, preferably to Jason Wynn, because then that way, if he's still continuing, I'm talking about myself in third
person.
If he is continuing to distribute copyrighted material, they'll have something on me, and then they can take me to court. As it is right now, I'm not doing anything. I haven't leaked anything, and I haven't continued the website, Avoid JW, or anything else. So there's no more connections to me, because they need that to be able to bring me to court and get an injunction against me. Right now, they can't even get an injunction against me. And then if I break the injunction, then they can go and sue me for whatever I'm worth. So they still have quite a road to go. And the road is an impossible one, because one, I don't own or operate or use Avoid JW. Well, I do use, I do and read the articles. But I don't. There was some other website they mentioned as well, and that's not mine either.
Jason, let me ask you.
Am I waffling?
You're fascinating. It's a lovely waffle. I love listening to you and spending time with you. But there was something I want to pick up, which you said about 5 minutes ago, and that was that the Watchtower got in first on the news article in the Business Post, because that's an important point that you picked out, because my cousin mentioned to me, you notice that they always inoculate the people when they know there's some information coming, they will get in first. And in fact, Stephen Unthank said the same thing to me. He said that what tends to happen is they will get in with their positive PR. Like, they will lobby and they will give you a good news story when they know that there's something happening in a particular area. So if people listening to this notice, for example, policy changes or doctrine changes happen after an event, they are then, you know, making up for lost ground. But what they tend to do is get ahead of the curve and actually put in the positive PR. So it was fantastic that the newspaper came to you and asked for a balanced perspective. So well done on that.
Yeah, it's a great newspaper. And I have to say, working with Barry White, he's a phenomenal journalist.
It was a great story. And I didn't know there were only 6,000 Jehovah's Witnesses in Ireland. That's really interesting. Now, before you let Avoid JW go, when it was still, when you started it up and you were still looking after it, you helped a number of places. So I want to hear more about that. So, for example, you assisted the UK Charity Commission. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, can we talk about that? That was extremely interesting, because what happened was I was given a whole load of magazines. So I don't know if you go back to about 2015 or 16, so it was impossible to get the Watchtower and Awake magazines from the period 1950 up to until the 2010. So you could get everyone from 2010 onward because they're on JW.org, but you couldn't get the previous ones. You could get here and there a couple of them. If you looked really hard, but you couldn't get the whole lot. And then someone sent them all to me, the whole lot, and said, "Here they are, put them up on the net so that people have access to them." So up we did, we put them all up on the net. But I got them on the Sunday night, Sunday morning, early Sunday morning. I then went to bed and I got up the next day and I got an email from a lady, can't think of her. Is it Maurice Ewart? She's in the UK.
Yeah, Maurice Ewart.
But anyway, she sent me an email and she says, look, the UK Charity Commission are looking for these letters, and she had the dates of them, and they're looking for these magazines, and she had the dates of those. And I said, you wouldn't believe it, but I said, I have most of the letters. There's two I don't have, but I have most of the letters. And I just last night got the magazines, so I can give you those too. So she just said, look, send them on to the UK Charity Commission yourself. And she gave me the email address of the guy. Jonathan was his name. I can't think of his surname.
But
I sent them off to Jonathan. And
Jonathan Sanders.
He came back to me on Monday morning and he just went, wow, this is incredible. Thank you very much. So that helped the UK Charity Commission in their investigations. Now, that's the extent that I went in, that gave them a few policy documents and a number of magazines, but it was great, the timing, you know. And what I found interesting about a lot of my activism is just the number of coincidences that seem to happen.
Yeah.
If you believed in God, you'd nearly think he was here helping.
Yeah. Or she.
Or she.
Yeah.
Or he.
Yeah. Now tell us, you also helped some other countries, because you've provided support into, like you just said, England and Wales through the UK Charity Commission and Ireland, but you also provided some help to Norway and the Netherlands. Can you tell us about Norway? What did you do there?
So, okay, so when I'm talking, I'm not talking about myself. I should make that very clear, because even with the UK Charity Commission, it wasn't me. Someone gave me magazines and then I was able to send them on. It was someone else that leaks the policy documents, and I was given access to them and I sent them on. So it's not me. And I don't like to think of things that I do as being me. So when it came to Norway, the Froda Komoda is the username he goes by up on Reddit, and he's also a moderator on there. A really, really nice guy. And we kind of built up a relationship, but he was telling me that they've been writing an article about Jehovah's Witnesses, and they're going to do a big 12 page. And he says, look, the manual is available in English and other languages, but we don't have it in Norwegian. Is there any way you can get it? And I says, leave it with me. 10 minutes later, I had it. So there you go. All I had to do was make a quick call to one of my contacts. That contact just says, yep, here you go, and sent it on to me, and I was able to send it on to them. And they wrote up. Their whole article, The Elder, was nearly based on that manual, you know, and the contents of it. So that's how I helped Norway.
Now, we met someone, didn't we? Do you remember, Louise? We had about 15 countries, well, exactly 15 countries represented at the protest. And we met this awesome guy from Norway. He's actually originally Swedish, but he's an awesome guy by the name of Jonas. And a shout out to Jonas. I'm sure he'd help you in the future if you ever needed another contact.
Yeah.
Okay.
While we were in the area, we visited Reclaim Voices. So I'm really interested in what you did to help RTL, which is the media organisation in the Netherlands that they've been working with. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, the Netherlands has been interesting. See, a lot of people don't really understand what's going on in the Netherlands, because I think the Netherlands and what Reclaim Voices is doing is going to be, I believe, the most important country within the EU to shed a strong light on Jehovah's Witnesses and the child abuse problem. We thought it was going to be the UK, but we're finding that the UK Charity Commission isn't been progressing along as well as we'd like. But in the Netherlands, and what Reclaimed Voices are doing, I think what they're doing is phenomenal. And they've really got the media, the national media behind them there, to help them shine the light on Jehovah's Witnesses policy. You know, and they've done such tremendous work when you consider, like, they have so many victims that have come forward who are afraid to say, to utter the problems they've had with their abuse, but they now have Reclaim Voices to be that voice for them. And so Reclaim Voices, Raymond contacted me by email. Now, I hadn't heard of the guy before until the first email he sent me, and he says, look, we're looking for certain documents, and we're looking for policy documents in any languages, in Dutch if you can, and the manual. So they managed to get the Elder manual from me in Dutch, and they also got a few documents. Now, we didn't have a huge amount of documents, but I did manage to source a few more, and they sent them on, and that's helped them in showing to the media and also to government in the Netherlands that there are serious issues with child abuse within the organization at a policy level. You know, and see, once you can get the government to take a look at it, right, then you can see, right, they've been recording all this abuse. And now we have evidence to show that they record it. You know, like Jehovah's Witnesses, when they go into court cases, they always throw out the clergy penitent privilege card, as in, look, the Catholic Church, the Protestants, they can all use that card, so we can use it as well. The difference between Jehovah's Witnesses and Catholics, I think people need to understand, is within Catholicism, if a penitent comes into the church, it's of his own volition. If he goes into the confession box, it's of his own volition. And if he admits to his sins, it's of his own volition. But the Catholic Church doesn't record his sins. They just find out what he did wrong. This helps him to see that, you know, now that you've confessed it, you confess it to me, and in other words, you confessed it to God as well. You're now absolved of your sins, off you go. But not so only Jehovah's Witnesses. Jehovah's Witnesses, right, so all the mediocre sins, they're kind of ignored completely. You deal with them yourself. But then when it comes to what they consider the serious sins, we need to interrogate. So they'll interrogate, if it's child abuse, let's just focus on child abuse. They interrogate both the victim and the perpetrator. And at one stage, the victim and perpetrator together, thank God they've stopped doing that silly
malarkey. But they're interrogating, and they're trying to claim clergy penitent privilege. But there is no clergy penitent privilege, because what they've done is, first of all, they've got some information at first. It might have been the victim has reported it to elders. The elders then go to the body of elders. So as soon as those two elders go to the body of elders, the clergy penitent privilege is gone, because you've now informed other people.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And then, when there's an interrogation, furthermore, through a judicial committee, then it's totally gone. And then when you've gone and recorded it without the consent or even the knowledge of the penitent or perpetrator, and you've now given a copy to the headquarters, be it the regional headquarters, we'll say the UK or the Dutch branch, they then file that. You know, they used to keep hard copies. Now what they do is they scan it and they destroy the hard copy, scan it, they put it into a system called Hub. In that system called Hub, they put it into a section called Tracking Persons. So every person that's in fellowship for whatever reason or disassociated, all that information is kept at the local level in the congregation, but it's also kept at the branch, and it's kept on a tracking person. So read into that as you want. You might call it that we're all being tracked. Mm-hmm. All of us who have been disfellowshipped or disassociated. So,
yeah, Jason, can I say that in another way? What you've just described, this privilege that you just described. Mm-hmm. Can I just say that with using another analogy? So, yes. Because what comes to mind to me is legal privilege, and you'll understand this, Louise. There is a legal privilege between you and your lawyer if you have one.
Yeah.
And if you discuss something about a case with your lawyer, they have to keep it confidential.
Yeah.
But if you then go and speak to the media.
Yes.
And if you then go and speak to your friends.
Yeah.
About the case, there's no legal privilege between you and the media and between you and your friends.
Yeah.
So it's similar in that way, isn't it, Jason? That you go and speak to the priest, there might be a privilege between you two, but then your case is then told to others that weren't part of that privilege. So you're really trying to extend the privilege, and that doesn't exist. Is that right?
It's slightly different. Yeah. In that it's not the perpetrator of the sin that's telling the media.
Oh, that's right. That's right. You're quite right.
It's kind of like the lawyer telling all his lawyer friends, and then their lawyer friends are then sending it off to a headquarters office for filing.
That's right.
There, but it's not kept confidential. In the sense that it should be, because we're not talking about, you know, we're not talking about legal stuff. We're talking about sins.
Yeah.
And sins, if we're talking about sins and you want to keep the privilege of the confession, as it were, then that confession is to one person between you, that person, and God, not to a whole body of elders and not to be documented and kept on file. Why are you documented and kept on file? So, for example, if we look at the child abuse, it's documented and kept on file and kept on file in two locations. Why is it kept on file in two locations? And why are you?
Thank you. That is a great clarification. Thank you for making that really clear. Now, about the Netherlands, just before we go off about the Netherlands, because we visited Raymond as well. What I like about what they're doing, and this is different to what a lot of other countries have done, is, as you said, they're working with RTL. So RTL is the media company. And what they did is they started working with them beforehand. So whereas in other countries, we're finding people and finding people's stories about child abuse, for example, and then we try and take it to the media, and it's a big struggle to get your story in the paper. It probably only happens once every quarter that a journalist approaches you and says, are there any true stories you can share with us? But what I love about Reclaim Voices is they already had a connection to RTL. And RTL helped them to find these 300 people. And so I guess that collaboration has seemed to be much more effective, much quicker. As you said, they're the ones to watch because they already have the documents that, you know, you and others have sent to them. They already have a relationship. They have already found people, so they can get to where we got to much quicker than a 5-year period. So it's really got to thank you. Thank you for helping with the UK Charity Commission. Thank you for helping with Norway. And thank you for helping with the Netherlands. I know it's not just you, but you had the platform to help people.
So just on the Netherlands while we're there. So I've spoken to one of the journalists in RTL twice. Now, I forget. I talk to so many people that I forget what I've talked, who I've talked to and what I've talked about. It's just, you know, the stuff I do, there's so much going on that I have a tendency to forget things relating to certain activities simply because there's so much going on and I need to keep a focus on certain things. But I did talk to that journalist twice on two occasions, and both occasions it was for an hour. So an hour's conversation with a journalist is a long time, because you got to understand I can say an awful lot quite quickly and they're recording it, and then they can use that again then in any of their reports. But I think you should watch RTL and watch what's going on in the Netherlands. Keep focused on it, because I think it's going to be extremely important in the coming weeks and months. And I think just that there's going to be some news probably next week now in RTL that will be of extreme interest to all XJW. So keep an eye on that.
Jason, you told me when we were visiting you that you have your own discrimination case. And we heard earlier about how the circuit overseer refused to speak to you. Why did you make a claim of discrimination? And you told me you consider that others should take similar cases if, for example, they're blocked entry to an event. So can you just tell us about the background of your discrimination case and what you think others should do?
Right, so I can't talk about the discrimination case. Legally, I'm not allowed to talk about it. But what I suppose what I can tell you is why I took the discrimination case is because I felt that they were discriminating against me on my religious beliefs and were stopping me entering the assembly on that basis. So I took a case against them. Now, in Ireland, you can take a discrimination case against people, and there's quite an easy way to do it, and it doesn't cost any money to do so. Now, when it does get to a hearing stage, each person has to bear their own costs. No one else pays for it. So even if you win, you don't get your costs borne by the other party. So let's say if I won the case and I had a barrister and a solicitor with me, I'd have to pay for that myself. So why did I take, and why I feel others should take a case if they can and if it's easy and it doesn't cost them any money? I mean, if it's going to cost you too much money, maybe it's not worth your while. But I do think that Watchtower needs to stop just, you know, labeling people as apostates. Just because they no longer believe doesn't mean they're an apostate. Apostate is for someone who just stands away, you know, and no longer believes. But some people aren't really apostates, technically speaking. Some people still believe, but just have been hurt by the organization, and maybe still want to go to meetings and enjoy service if they so wish. But if you've never caused a disturbance, you should be allowed into a public building and a public event like any other public person. If they stop you going in, why are they stopping you going in? There must be a reason for them to stop you going in. If you've never done anything, now if you have been going into Kingdom Hall and you've been standing up and causing a ruckus, well, you deserve to be kicked out and not allowed back in, right? And I'll be very clear on that. But if you don't, if you go in, you sit down and you pay attention and you don't disturb anyone, you should be allowed to go to them as often as you like. Even if they try and get you to do something in a way that might cause a disturbance, but you don't, you know, they shouldn't be trying to, they cannot stop you going into a public event.
Exactly.
So I think any person that's ever gone to an event and has been stopped should take a case of discrimination. Now, in Ireland, we have a certain amount of days to do it. I can't remember how much. It might be 3 months or something, that you have to take the case within 3 months of it happening. I took my case within a month of it happening. And I think Watchtower was kind of surprised that I took that approach. But, you know, I never did anything. Really, I've gone to Kingdom Halls and I've sat down, I've listened. In fact, I've found that I'm paying more attention than anyone else.
Yeah.
You're awake and you're listening, you're kind of going, do you believe this nonsense? Yeah. But, you know, I've never caused a disturbance. Now, I did answer up one time, but the only reason I answered up was because the subject was on apostasy. It's in the Kingdom Rules Book, Chapter 11, paragraphs 18 to 21, if you ever want to look it up.
Mm.
And it was paragraph 18. And everyone was answering up until it got to paragraph 18. And on paragraph 18, I was in the audience. So people suddenly felt awkward because, you know, they all see apostate in the room. They don't want to go and talk about apostasy. So I answered the question. There was a big pause, you see, and no one's answering. He's looking around and everyone was feeling awkward. So I answered it. And as soon as I answered it, the coordinator of the body elders got up and told me to stop. And I was kind of confused why he's telling me to stop. I mean, I only answered the question. That's not a disturbance. I mean, it's a question and answer session. But, you know, if you've never caused a disturbance and they're trying to stop you going in. Now, in certain countries, maybe in the US, they can do that if they so wish. I mean, the laws in the US seem to be a bit stranger than the laws in Europe. But definitely in Europe, you can take a case of discrimination against anyone that tries to stop you going into to an event. Why are they trying to stop you going in? You know, unless you have, you know, if you've no history of doing anything, all right, they may not like you. I mean, I get it when people don't like me because I no longer believe. You know, Jehovah's Witnesses do no longer like family members that no longer believe. Hence why they shun them. You know,
anyone not spending time with you is really missing out because I like you. You're a very likable person. So it could only be, you know, made up rules that are preventing people from spending time with you. Because if I was your relative or a friend of yours that grew up with you in a kingdom hall, I couldn't not hang out with you. So hopefully that sort of thing will change in the future. But this is what this is all about. Can I ask you one last question before I hand over to Louise? But my last question is, in terms of where your activism's going now, last year you said to me you'd like to see more body of elders letters that were leaked. Is there anything else that would be good to leak if people are listening and they say, I want to help? Because Avoid JW, even though it's not yours, it is still going. What is it that you think in activism could be leaked that would be helpful?
You see, leaking is, I don't like the word leaking because it's not about leaking. Because, you know, some people kind of leak letters and whatever, and they go, oh, look, I've leaked a letter. It's not about leaking letters. The whole purpose of getting documents out there is so that we can use that as leverage to change policy for the better.
Mm.
You know, when you look at the leak of letters that related to child abuse, they were so bad up until 2012. I think October 1st, 2012 was the child abuse letter, and that was a bad letter, and all the ones previous to that were even worse. But in 2016, the August 1st, 2016 child abuse policy was an improvement, and then the September 1st, 2017 letter was even better. Now, it still isn't as good as it needs to be, but we're seeing improvements. And the only way to get improvements in policy is being able to get documents that are of importance and be able to give them, to put them into the hands of the right people who can put the pressure on Watchtower and other entities relating to Jehovah's Witnesses that can then change policy. Because if Jehovah's Witnesses are forced to, they will change policy. And I think what we've seen in the Australian Royal Commission was questions asked by Angus Stewart that really put Jehovah's Witnesses right up against the fence to the point where they had no choice but to change policy for the better. And that's, so it's not about leaking. This is the point I want to make. It's not about leaking. It's about getting letters or getting documents that will help to improve policy. Because if they're put into the right people's hands, we can get things changed. Yes. It's not like, oh, look, I got this letter. I got this letter. Look, everybody. We don't want that. It's fruitless.
So that's really interesting, Jason. That brings you to the heart of my original question about everything. My original question was, what is your motivation for doing this? And I'm not being critical because I ask myself this question all the time and my family ask me it and other people who love me and wish I'd drop activism ask me it. So it's not a bad question. It's a devil's advocate question. What is your motivation for doing this? But secondly, what do you think that you're doing that is useful?
Oh, that's a good question. So, well, the motivation for doing it is to see wrongs righted.
Yes.
That's really it. Yes. Seeing wrongs righted. Once they're righted, I'd walk away.
Yeah.
I even emailed the coordinators committee of Jehovah's Witnesses. Now, the coordinators committee is the most important committee, governing body committee in Jehovah's Witnesses, because that's mainly made up of governing body members.
Right.
Except for one helper, but the rest are all governing body members. And I emailed them and I said, look, you're going after here with subpoenas and looking for people and chasing people, which is subpoenas, but you're only addressing the symptoms. You're not addressing the cause. I says, why are we here in the first place? And how do you get rid of us? Things to be happening is that we're increasing in number. I mean, all you have to do is go onto Reddit and you see that it's gone. I mean, when I joined up over a year ago, it was about 12,000. It's now up nearly at 26,000. It's at 25,880 or something. But, you know, so we're growing in numbers of XJWs.
Yeah.
And a lot of those people do their own thing in their own way. And it can be a form of activism or it can be a form of helping other members that are hurting and so forth. And so that causes additional problems for Watchtower, whether they want to admit it or not. That causes huge problems. I mean, me, myself, and you, Louise, and you, Lara, you're all just one person, but you're one powerful person. That the more of those there are, like, I always think that one JW activist is equivalent to 1,000 JWs, because 1,000 JWs can just go around knocking on doors and and licking up la 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 more spiritual food. But an activist is showing, well, look, this is what they're doing and this is how wrong it is, and that they're doing it for this reason, and that sends out a powerful message to non-JWs, more powerful than knocking on the door or annoying them with a magazine. And this is big problems for Watchtower. And unless they address the cause instead of the symptoms, we're always going to win. And they might think that they're growing in numbers, but it's they have a false economy in a sense, because what they have is they're using the shunning to keep members in and to keep control of members. But what they have is a lot of members who don't want to be members. Now, all you need is one or two in any congregation of those to cause a cancer. You know, all it has to do is someone who's chemo, all they have to do is ask a number of different questions subtly to others, and then suddenly what you have is that cancer is growing. And you don't want a cancer. What you want to do is you want to cut out the cancer. And the best way to cut out the cancer is end the shunning.
Yeah.
And let the people who want to leave, leave, and those who want to stay, stay.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, Catholics don't use shunning.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone that's Catholic stays Catholic and wants to be Catholic. And even if there's the child abuse, they still want to be Catholic and they're proud to be Catholic. You know, what you want to do by controlling, keeping people in there, it's nonsense. A lot of people want to believe in the paradise and want to live forever in paradise and earth. And then there's those who want to go to heaven. And that's your belief, and let them believe it. I mean, that gives people comfort. See, there's a difference between me as an activist and a lot of other XJWs. Some XJWs are trying to get people out of the religion. I'm not. Strangely enough, I like my mom being a Jehovah's Witness. It suits her. She believes that she's going to go to paradise, and that's great, and so does my sister, and that's great. And I have never once ever told them that you stop believing. You need to stop believing and you need to talk to me again. No, you can keep believing, but I think you should still talk to me. And because the thing is, right, so they talked to me. So I'm out 17 years, and so it's about 7 years now that they haven't spoken to me. And in those first 10 years, if I asked them, was there once ever that I asked you to stop being a Jehovah's Witness? So, no, they wouldn't be able to answer. They couldn't, because I have not tried to change their beliefs. But Jehovah's Witness as leadership, they are obsessed with thinking that we're all out to change them and get them out of the religion. And I don't see why they need to have this obsession.
That's their standard line, isn't it? Their standard line is, and apostates try to draw people away after them. And that's the phobia that they inculcate into people. The phobia is they will try to draw you away after them. And we're not. I don't care if people leave or not. I want people to stay in. I just want them to stay in under the full knowledge of the facts that they're hiding paedophiles. That I just want them to know, but stay in. I don't care if they leave or not.
Yes. See, that's it. But why do they think... And do you know what? I actually think that the governing body think that's how we think, that we want to draw them away.
I don't think they do think that. I think that they say that because it's easier to have an us and them ideal. Us and them, us and them. We stay in, they try to draw us away after them wicked people. And if you can create an us and them, that's where you get a cult.
Yeah, I think it's very strange because most of the ex-JWs that I've spoken to, you know, like when we were JWs and we were looking out at the, we'll say those that were shown, we always think, well, they're up to no good.
Yeah.
They're doing really bad stuff. Yeah.
Because you know, we have to be frightened of them.
I look at most of the ex-JWs that I've met and, you know, there's a lot that don't drink, don't do drugs, yeah. Don't smoke.
Get married.
Have morals. Everything.
Yeah.
You know, they're actually just normal human beings just trying to get on with life like everybody else.
But Jason, if we acknowledge that people who left the witnesses were normal, ethical, moral human beings, what would there be to be scared of? What would there be to stop people leaving? So you have to postulate them as frightening them. Them, they're from Satan, they do wicked things, they try to draw you away. If you can't make it frightening, you won't frighten people, and that's the bottom line.
But see, that's the problem. Why do you have to frighten people? I mean,
you have to frighten people to keep them in.
You don't. See, that's the false idea straight away. You don't have to keep anyone in anything. People will believe if they believe.
Okay.
You know, okay, right, so look at Scientology. Yeah. One of the most ridiculous religions on the planet. But yet people believe in us.
I don't think you're thinking like a cult leader. I think you're thinking like an ethical, moral, cognitive, metacognitive human being.
Yeah, I don't think I'll ever be a cult leader.
No, I don't think you will. No. Thinking like that, you'll be a shit cult leader, Jason. A shit cult leader.
Because I was going to create my own cult and I was going to call it J-O-ism.
Oh, it's not going to happen. No, you're not frightening people enough. What you need is an us and them, us and them. And you're just not making it. Us and them and fear is what keeps people in a cult.
It does. And lack of education is a sure way to keep them in.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, a couple of readings of The Awake is way better than 4 years in college.
No, but it really is. It really is. That article in The Awake that said, oh, you taught me how to make bread and I cried. That's much better than, you know, a 6-week course on astronomy. Oh, dear. So, in conclusion, have Watchtower hounded you off the internet?
Have they what?
Have they hounded you off the internet?
No, so Watchtower issues a serious amount of subpoenas, first of all. And that was just to try to find the identity of the person. But, I mean, they could have got the identity of me a lot sooner just by talking to the UK branch, who would have been talking to the elders of my local congregation.
Right.
Because I've been having conversations with them, which were quite interesting. But anyway, they did the subpoena route, and then they went and wrote this extremely serious letter that, you know, if these websites aren't shut down, if I don't submit to the Southern Court of New York, and if I didn't keep it all confidential, by the way, yeah, so this is what I'm telling you now is extremely confidential. Don't tell anyone.
We only have 3 listeners, so that's fine.
This is all 3, I hope.
Yeah, no, honestly, we do.
Yeah, see, at some stage, I've got so many letters that were issued to me from various people. You know, there's I have a whole file on files. You know, people are worried about the subpoena thing. Don't be worried about the subpoena thing. The subpoena thing is not something to be worried about. That's only to find information about someone. What you need to be worried about is if you continue in a certain course that may be allegedly considered illegal in certain jurisdictions, but you've stopped, well, then you have nothing more to worry about.
Right.
Because what happens with copyright is
is if they tell you to stop and you don't stop, then they can get a court order, which is called an injunction, to stop you doing it any further. So that if you then continue doing it, then they can go to court and get damages awarded towards them for any loss of earnings or any other damage that you might do to their trade or name. So people who are worrying about it, stop worrying about it. Unless you're continuing to do it. But I think there's so many ex-JWs and there's so many that are willing to be able to put stuff out there that even if they, you know that little game where the frogs pop up?
Yeah, whack-a-mole.
That's it. You're whacking those all down. This is what Watchtower is at. It's absolutely...
They're playing whack-a-mole.
It's futile. Crazy. Because what they do is whacking one up, another one will pop up somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know, and at the end of the day, all they're doing is threatening ex-JWs, and ex-JWs aren't even the source. The source are those within. You know, I've never been an elder. I've never been a ministerial servant. I was never a pioneer. I mean, I was kind of one of the worst publishers. I didn't even donate. I mean, I probably put in a coin here and there that someone might have given me for a magazine. And that was it. I was actually the worst JW in terms of being an asset. But now what I've done is, they've just pissed off someone.
You've made a formidable enemy.
He's caused a lot more damage in terms of that. Governments are now looking at them and looking more closely at them. And even you have court cases happening where they're losing loads of money. I mean, I helped in the Fessler case there in February 2017 over Pennsylvania. And she won that case, you know, for an undisclosed sum. And now there's the case next week starting on Monday in Montana. And I'm sure I'll be called up to help out there.
Amazing.
And who knows how much those two ladies might be awarded. But amazing. I don't think Watchtower have much of a hope there either. When you look at it the whole way, see, what Watchtower have been trying to do there is just try and stop it. Yeah. Stop the case. And they've been trying hard as possible just to stop the case, even going to the Supreme Court to try and stop the case. But it's going ahead. And so once it goes ahead, that's it. Watchtower have already lost before they even go in the room.
Yeah.
You know, and so it'll be interesting to see how that goes. And I think every ex-JW, especially victims of child abuse, should be watching that, because I think it helps to empower victims of abuse to be able to see that Watchtower were wrong. Massively.
Yeah. When I did my protest, which I'm not defending because lots of people don't like protest, and I get that. But one of the things it did was the people who had very personal stories against Watchtower who came along and were supported felt they'd got their voice back, and they just felt empowered. They felt like, I've been validated, I've been heard. And instead of being denied and told that didn't happen, they just felt, I've been heard today. And that was so powerful. Yeah.
So, actually, I just want to ask you a question, just to clarify. Mm. You said you did a protest. What protest was this?
So, I arranged a protest in London at the XL, outside the XL arena in...
That protest, that's a peaceful protest.
Oh, it was totally peaceful. We stood...
You weren't going in disrupting...
No, we didn't go inside at all.
Some people seem to think that protesting is all about shouting and screaming.
No, isn't it funny? Because like
disrupting events, but that's not a protest.
It wasn't at all.
That's causing a disturbance.
We didn't make any. We didn't shout. You know, somebody brought a tutor along, and we went, "No, put it away." There's no shouting. There's no. Yeah. And in fact, I'll tell you what. XL Security provided barriers for us, and we stood behind the barriers. And they said, "You don't shout at people." And we were like, "We don't want to shout at people." But what we found was, because we were quiet and because we just stood, lots of people came up to us quietly. If we'd have been shouting, "Rah rah rah, you this, you that," they wouldn't have come physically. They wouldn't have come near us. But because we were just stood, saying nothing, quite a lot of people came right up to us and spoke to us quietly. And in between the sessions, when witnesses should have been sat in listening to the speechifying, they came out and they came up to us and they spoke to us quietly because we were stood quietly. And it was amazing.
See, that's the right kind of protesting.
It was incredible.
I think people need to differentiate between protesting and causing a disturbance.
Oh, definitely.
Into a Kingdom Hall and stopping an event, disrupting an event, is causing a disturbance. That's protesting.
We just stood. with banners, silently. And you know what? Who did the shouting? Some of the Jehovah's Witnesses came up to us and shouted, and they shouted at Karen Morgan, who's an abuse victim, and said, "Oh, there, this isn't true, this is a lie." And she went, no, this is me. This was, and they, their faces, they were mortified. They went, "Oh my God, was that you?" And she went, "Yeah, this is me." And they were amazed. Shall we wrap up?
Yeah.
Lara, is she there?
I think it's a really appropriate time to introduce the song that I've picked for you, Jason.
Thank you.
So the song is by Sinead O'Connor, an Irish artist, and she sang a song that was an a cappella version of Bob Marley's song called War. And you might remember this because this was very controversial, because in 1992 she appeared on Saturday Night, the TV show, and sang this a cappella version. And it was intended as a protest against sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. And her career really dive-bombed after this. Now we know everything she was representing is true. And the end of her singing the song, she presented a photo of the Pope, which was John Paul II at the time, and she sang the word evil, after which she tore up the photo.
Wow.
So I think this is appropriate because it's a peaceful war that we're in now. So please enjoy it. Say hi to your wife and the kids, and thank you for coming on.
Thank you very much, ladies. I've enjoyed myself.
Oh, Jason, I am so happy to finally have spoken to you. You're my other god of activism, and it's a privilege to have had you on. Thank you so much.
And thank you.
And thank you to everyone for listening. All my three listeners to listening to JW Community Podcast. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Until the philosophy which holds one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned, everywhere is war. Until there's no longer first class or second class citizens of any nation. Until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes, I've got to say war. That until the basic human rights are equally guaranteed to all without regard to race, I say war. Until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, and the rule of international morality will remain just a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. And everywhere is war. Until the ignoble and unhappy regime which holds all of us through child abuse, yeah, child abuse, yeah, subhuman bondage has been toppled, utterly destroyed. Everywhere is war. War in the East, war in the West, war up North, war down South. There's war and the rumors of war. Until that day, there is no continent which will know peace. Children, children, fight. We find it necessary. We know we will win. We have confidence in the victory of good over evil. fight the real enemy,